But now, all right, so now I'm comfortable. I can usually get up in front of 3,000 people. My heart doesn't even skip a beat. But I have been nervous about you. And the reason I've been nervous about you is I feel like there probably isn't anything I can say that you haven't heard before, including things I haven't said yet. And some of you have probably heard them, you know, like how many of you, all right, how many of you have seen Killing Us Softly? Right. How many of you have seen it more than 100 times? See, so I knew I had to do something new and different. So the good news is I'm doing something completely new. The bad news is I'm doing something completely new. And that means that it could be, you know, this could be over in 10 minutes. I haven't really done it before, or it could go on longer than that. And I'm not going to be doing quite what is advertised as I am going to talk about So Sexy So Soon. But when Rob and I were talking about this, it was maybe a year ago, and my hope was that this book that I'm working on, So Sexy So Soon, The Sexualization of Childhood, would be done. Well, it's not. It's nowhere near done. So I don't have all the material that I would hope that I would have. So what I'm going to do instead is it's a work in progress. I'm going to talk a little bit about the sexualization of childhood and then a little bit about the corruption of relationships in advertising in general. So it'll be a little bit different from what the advertising was. And then I'll open it up so there'll be plenty of time for discussion and for questions and that sort of thing. And if this isn't what you want, it's not too late to go to another session or go outside, and I won't be offended. But if you are here, and you are, I will be around later on, and I'd be happy to talk to you. And also, I do have a website, a fabulous website, designed and run by Nina Hunteman, who's right here, my good friend and colleague. You can go to this website, and there's an extensive resource list on the website and all kinds of organizations and places to get further information, as well as information about my lecture schedule and my books and films and that sort of thing. Well, I started looking at ads in the late 60s, and I started lecturing in the early 1970s and made Killing Us Softly for the first time in 1979, and then again, of course, in 87, and then again in 2000. And I started even in the early version of Killing Us Softly talking about the sexualization of childhood, the sexualization of little girls. And I remember one of the ads I used early on was this one. It says, "Very Cherry." And it's, you know, struck me that this was, you know, not a coincidence, the language and that sort of thing, or her sultry expression, but I had no idea how bad it was going to get. I mean, this is so tame compared to, you know, what has come along since, and that there's so much of it now, and it is everywhere, and we're getting more and more of these images, and also more and more of, you know, little girls being encouraged to emulate them in lots of different ways. And also fashions that are aimed at, you know, for little girls that are very provocative. And we're even getting things like this, a little shirt for a baby called Pimp Squad. So things that would have been, you know, unthinkable not that long ago really are becoming very normal. In the same way, another image that I used in the film originally was this one, because innocence is sexier than you think. And this was a shocking image in those days. This was in the late 70s, and this was shocking. I mean, the whole idea of linking innocence and sexiness, the whole idea of dressing a woman like a little girl, all of it was shocking. Maybe even the phallic imagery of the product and the way she's sitting and she's lifting her skirt and all of that. So that was considered shocking, and nowadays we have stuff like this. You know, this is an ad for Lee Jeans. Now, this is from Australia, and there's a whole series of ads that are just amazing in this. They're clearly based on kiddie porn. And when there was a lot of uproar in Australia, feminists in Australia, you know, sensible people in Australia, all kinds of people saying something about it, Lee said, "Oh well, you know, she's over 18. This isn't child pornography." And then there's things like this ad. We don't have young Japanese girls on sale right now, but we do have these. So all this stuff that's becoming really mainstream. So one of the things that, as I noticed this happening more and more, I became interested in the topic and wanted to do a book on it. And also, I became interested as a mother of a teenage girl. My daughter's 19 now, but I've been interested for a long time watching what she was going through as she hit adolescence. And what I've noticed, both as a researcher and as a mother of a teenage girl, are several things. I'll just give you a few examples. there's a G-strings and thongs are sold to little girls in mainstream stores like Target and JCPenney. I did an interview a few weeks ago with a reporter who'd found padded bras for 8-year-olds, 7- and 8-year-olds, sold in these mainstream department stores. Fitted T-shirts with slogans like, "So many boys, so little time," aimed at 6-year-old, 7-year-old girls. So that's happening out there. Barbie, of course, is we've got things like American Idol Barbie now. And we've got the Bratz dolls, which some of you may be familiar with. I don't have a picture of them, but they make Barbie look prim and proper. Here's lingerie Barbie. You know, this is just what your 3-year-old needs. And at the same time, we've got stores like Abercrombie sending out catalogs. You know, this is a huge poster in their store, their clothing store, I might add, but anyway. and they send these catalogs into our homes. You know, I remember my daughter was about 13, 14 when they started coming in, and one of the catalogs actually suggested threesomes to teenagers as a remedy for because sex can be so boring when it's just between two people. So anyway, I've also observed things such as that some parents, especially in certain parts of the country, are giving breast implants to their daughters as high school graduation presents and as Sweet 16 presents. And a professor of plastic surgery at the University of Southern California in LA said breasts are a fashion item. So these are some of the stuff that's going on, and you all have stories. And actually, one of the reasons I'm doing this and one of the reasons I'm I would love to hear from you, because I'm collecting anecdotes and stories, and everywhere I go when I say I'm working on this book, everybody says, "Oh, thank God, you know, my daughter this or my niece that." And so if you have stories and anecdotes and things you've noticed, please, or ads or anything like that, but just stories, email them to me. I'd really be very interested in them. And I'm writing this book, by the way, with Diane Levin. We're co-authoring it. And she's an expert on early childhood development and very involved with the campaign for commercial-free childhood. So she's doing a lot of work on the younger kids, and I'm dealing more with the tweens and the teens. So what's going on here? Who's marketing this stuff? I mean, who's buying it? Why? How is it affecting children and teens? And how come it seems that the only people who are making a fuss about it are on the Christian right? I mean, it's only a kind of... It's very difficult to talk about in a way because one immediately gets lumped into a sort of being anti-sex or anti-sex education or something like that. In fact, the United States is the only developed nation in the world that doesn't teach sex ed in the schools. I think a lot of people are afraid that if we teach sex to kids in the schools, they might think about it. You know, they might. Luckily, otherwise they don't. So it's, you know, we're protecting them. And what people don't realize is that, of course, our children are getting sex ed all the time, but they're getting it from the popular culture and from the media. They're awash in sexual images and messages in films and TV programs and the internet, video games, everywhere we look. So even little children today have been exposed to far more sexual information than ever before in human history. And I know that, I mean, there are places where little kids would be in the same little space as their parents would observe intercourse, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a whole lot of other stuff that little kids are being exposed to, the kinds of pornography that's available on the internet, all of that. So they're exposed to much more information, but this doesn't necessarily mean that they understand it or that they're processing it in any kind of way that makes sense. In fact, I remember when my daughter was about 11, she'd kill me if she knew I was saying this, but she's not here, so don't tell her if you run into her later. She's here. Anyway, when she was about 11, she said to me, "What's oral sex?" And then she said, "I think I know, but I just want to be sure." Well, I wasn't quite ready for this question yet. You know, I was expecting it a little later. And so I said, "What do you think it is?" And she said, "I think it's when you talk about it." And I said, "Right." More or less. So that's it was such an example to me, though, that she would know something but not, you know. And so there's a lot of, in a sense, kind of a veneer of sophistication, but there's also an incredible amount of confusion and misinformation, as you all know. So they're bombarded with all of this information that they really can't process, that they're not developmentally ready to process. And, of course, this has an impact on their development, on their behavior, And they're very routinely exposed to images of sexual behavior that are absolutely separate from relationships, from any kind of feeling, really, any kind of emotion. And they receive many messages about themselves and about the world. And basically what they learn, I think, is that sex is the defining activity in relationships, that it's to the exclusion of love and friendship. And in fact, it often occurs totally outside of relationships. Sex is sometimes, in fact, often linked to violence. And, of course, their sexual success, their sexual value, depends entirely on how they look, you know, on what their appearance is. And that that appearance is what is very narrowly defined, as, you know, I've gone into in the past, as you know. So these messages, I think, shape their gender identity, their sexual attitudes, their behaviors, their values, and also a lot, to a great extent, their capacity for love and for authentic connection, and well into adulthood. Now, one of the challenges of this topic is separating sexualization from sexuality. You know, that sexuality, of course, is to be celebrated. We're all sexual beings from birth, and that's fabulous. But and I'm certainly part company with those who are afraid of the sexuality of young people, particularly teenagers. There's such terror of sexuality of teenagers, and who want to punish them for it. So sexuality and sexualization have to be really kept separate. Sexualization is the process, really, of turning people into objects, into things, and rather than as people with legitimate needs of their own and feelings of their own. And when individuals are sexualized, several things happen. For one thing, their value comes primarily from their sexual appeal. Physical attractiveness is what's necessary in order to be considered sexy, and the people, particularly women, but everybody, becomes passive things for others' use rather than having any kind of sexual agency in and of themselves. So it's particularly problematic for children and for adolescents who are developing their sense of themselves as individuals and as sexual beings. And it occurs in at least three distinct ways. Let me go back to then. Culturally, of course, they're influenced by the messages around them. Interpersonally, the way they're treated by their families, by their peers, by other people. And perhaps most damaging of all, it's internalized. And they internalize standards as they learn to sexualize themselves. You have the right to remain sexy. And this is such a classically stereotyped, cliched definition of what it means to be sexy for a woman or for a girl, but it's all there is. It's all that there is, and of course, our tweens and our teens sort of seek to emulate it. And even in recent years, a lot of girls, a lot of young women are saying that turning themselves into sex objects is empowering, that somehow it's related to having sexual agency. I don't see it that way, but sexualization happens disproportionately to girls and to women, but it's nonetheless, of course, harmful to boys and to men. For girls and women, it's much more being turned into objects, whereas for boys and men, it's much more about always being ready for sex, always being on the make, even very little boys. You know, so there's all these ads where little boys are sort of looking up adult women's skirts and that sort of thing. Or this amazing thing that was in the newspaper recently, this little boy, he's 5 years old, and it says, and he's surrounded by the Texas bikini team, and it says, "We imagine Clark Foster, 5, is the envy of all his friends, maybe dad too." Doubt it, you know. I mean, the poor kid looks completely bewildered, you know, and look, he's giving the thumbs up sign. I mean, it's just ridiculous, and yet this happens over and over again to little boys. So children struggle to make sense of the content of all of this, and they're not capable of interpreting it in the way that adults do, so they're particularly vulnerable. And also, in the meantime, they're robbed of valuable time for sex-appropriate sort of lessons and development and all of that that are necessary to lay the foundation for positive sexual relationships in the future. And many children suffer other consequences as well, as we all know, eating disorders, self-mutilation, low self-esteem, as well as alienation from their parents, their families, and other caring adults. Sexualization makes it more difficult, if not impossible, for people to have healthy, intimate relationships. And on a societal level, it fosters sexual violence and sexist attitudes and encourages sexual violence. And it's also highly likely that the sexualization of children contributes to child sexual abuse, a huge problem, of course. At least 1 in 4 girls in America and at least 1 in 6 boys are sexually abused during their childhood. Now, I'm not saying that images in the media cause this problem, but I think they contribute to it by creating a climate in which it becomes increasingly acceptable to look upon children in this way, and of course much more likely to blame the victim. When children are constantly presented as seductive and sexy, then it's much easier to say that the five-year-old asked for it. You know, when JonBenet is referred to as a beauty queen, you know, it sort of completely takes away from the fact that she was a sexually abused and exploited child. So what happens to these children as they grow up? Well, some of the consequences. Here are some items that I've just noticed, ripped from the headlines, as they say. Four students at a Maryland high school are arrested for performing sex acts in the school parking lot. Middle school girls perform lap dances for boys at school dances and make out with each other in order to excite boys. Five popular hockey players are expelled from an exclusive private high school outside of Boston for receiving oral sex in the locker room from a 15-year-old girl, who was also suspended. Five students at an inner-city elementary school in Boston are suspended for sexual harassment stemming from an incident on a school bus that involved lewd language and touching. And when asked about it, one of the kids said they were playing the rape game. This is elementary school, the rape game. The age of teen prostitutes on the street is steadily dropping. 4 years ago, the average was 15 or 16. Today, it's 12 and 13. And these are all just things I've read in the paper in the past couple of months. A lacrosse player at Duke University, you're all aware of that, of what happened at Duke, but one of the players sent an email to his teammates after a party in which a young woman allegedly was raped, in which he outlined his plans to have some strippers over to his dorm the next night and to kill the bitches as soon as they walked in, and that his plans were killing the bitches as soon as they walked in and then cutting their skin off while coming in my Duke issue spandex. So this was the email that he sent to his teammates. So, I mean, it's just so horrifying. One of the reasons I'm having trouble with this book is it's just so depressing. But why is this happening, and why is it happening now? Well, certainly a popular culture that, you know, assaults children with messages like this is a major factor. And the popular culture is the leading source of sex education in the nation. Here we have, you know, Cosmo Girl, the sexiest guys in the world issue, or this one, which is actually the one that's read by teenagers and tweens, The Sex He Craves, How to Give It to Him. The typical child or teenage viewer who watches an average of 3 to 5 hours of television a day sees a minimum of 2,000 sex acts per year on television alone, and there's also all sorts of sexual activity, as you know, in the music video and the games and the cartoons and song lyrics and all of that. All of it, or almost all of it, portraying sexual behavior as consequence-free, and much of it exploiting women's bodies and glamorizing sexual violence. And not surprisingly, the research confirms that being exposed to this affects people. What a surprise. It contributes to earlier sexual activity among children as well as certain kinds of attitudes. Now, in my work, of course, I've focused on advertising because I think it's the engine that drives the mass media. And young people today are surrounded by far more graphic sexual messages than ever before. Images that used to belong to the world of pornography are now common in our magazines and our newspapers and our television shows. I mean, this is an ad for jeans, although something seems to be missing. And ads like this, very, very graphic ads that would have been shocking a few years ago. Again, in ads aimed at kids. And always portraying a certain kind of attitude about sex. Now, again, it can be hard to talk about this sometimes because then people say, oh, well, you know, isn't this great, all this, to have all this sexual openness and honesty? Well, I don't think so. First of all, I don't think there is a lot of sexual openness and honesty in the culture. There's just a lot of images of sex used to sell stuff. And I also think that the impact of all of this, these sexual messages, is really profoundly anti-erotic. I think that it's anti-erotic because the message that is sent out is that, first of all, sex is by far the most important thing in life, but secondly, it belongs only to the young and beautiful. If you're not young and perfect-looking, you have no sexuality. So it totally erases the sexuality of anyone who isn't extremely young, perfect-looking, and actually looking rather bored. That seems to be part of it, too. And so it's... I think it actually makes everybody... real people feel less desirable. It certainly makes real women feel less desirable. It's hard to feel sexy when you hate your body, for starters. And And I don't think it does wonders for men either. And it makes all of us feel like we're missing out, like everybody else must be having these incredible sex lives, and, you know, ours are pretty humdrum by comparison. So I think the impact is really, I don't think it's surprising that the main complaint I've read of couples going in to see sex therapists these days is loss of desire. So we're awash in these graphic images and all this stuff, and everybody's starting to feel sort of numb and desensitized, which is not surprising. Well, the teenagers are, of course, hypersexualized. Forgive me for using such an old image here. here's another Abercrombie threesome. You can learn more about anatomy after school, which manages to trivialize sex, relationships, and education all in one sentence. And the basic message that the kids are getting about sex is an incredibly impersonal one, as in this beer ad, names optional. Names optional. Get drunk, have sex. You don't even have to, you don't see the faces, they're just the bodies, and you don't even need to know each other's names. And there's, of course, tremendous objectification of women that goes along with this all the time. Tastes great, goes down easy. They're so subtle. And at the same time, there's rarely any accurate information about sex, and certainly never any emphasis on relationships or on intimacy. And to make matters worse, we have to fight to get any sort of sex education into our schools, let alone the kinds of broad-based programs that are so desperately needed. Of course, the Bush administration refuses to fund any program that doesn't insist on abstinence as the only choice that's suitable for young people. Just say no. But you know all this. So I could talk about objectification and sexualization and the link with violence and child sexual abuse, but I think you do know all about, and you know what I have to say on this topic. So in the time I have left, I want to take a few minutes to look at something else that's going on, something that I think is relatively unexplored, and that is the sexualization of products. And because not only are people objectified in ads, but products are sexualized, and this is something that's happening more and more, and I've been observing it for several years. It's actually the main theme of my book, Can't Buy My Love, but it's happening more and more. So we are encouraged to feel passion for our products rather than our partners. And the reason is, and this is probably the most important point I think I have to make, is that all these sexual images aren't intended to sell us on sex, or our children on sex even. They're intended to sell us on shopping. You know, the desire they want to inculcate is not for, you know, orgasm. It's for more gizmos, basically. That's what they're after. They're selling shopping to us. As Cynthia Peters says in this a wonderful ZNet commentary, sexuality is a potentially dangerous, independent island nation, a rogue state that must be brought into the service of the marketplace from an early age. Teach 7-year-olds that sexual expression is a matter of accessorizing, and you've secured a lifetime of purchases in the lingerie department. And this, I think, is what is most chilling about what's happening. And she goes on to say, and this is important too, disassociate sex from non-market feelings, pleasure, desire, intimacy, and associate it with consumable superficialities, and you'll not only keep the rabble in line, you'll have them lined up at the mall. So this is an issue that's unbelievably important. I mean, because of the impact that it's having on our children sexually, but also because of the way that it's undermining freedom, democracy, our ability to think for ourselves, all of that. And I think that that's not an overstatement to say that. So the exploitation, the way they do this, takes many forms. But I'm going to look now quickly at the way that they do it in advertising. How do they get us to dissociate sex from non-market feelings and associate it with consumable superficialities? Well, one of the ways is to make us fall for our products, to feel that our, you know, to feel that we're committed to our brands rather than to each other. And obviously, advertising teaches us early on that the whole point of life is to buy as much as possible. He'll make you laugh. He'll make you cry. He'll make you buy him lots of stuff. And we all know, I think everybody here knows now, that they've learned that babies at the age of 6 months now can recognize corporate logos. So that's the age at which they're starting to target our kids. 6 months old is when they can recognize corporate logos. I did an interview a while ago about a new trend where pregnant women were selling the space on their bellies for tattoos of corporate logos. See, you know about that. And do you know also about the parents that are auctioning off the rights to name their babies to be after a brand in exchange for a certain amount of money? So little Exxon can go through life, you know, totally scarred because his parents are morons. But So increasingly, advertising has always been the propaganda of capitalism. It's always taught us that to be above all consumers, that products can fulfill us, can make us happy, can meet our deepest human needs. But increasingly, the ads are telling us that products will add excitement to our lives, will make us feel alive, will make us feel loved. The most exciting thing to happen to your face since your first kiss. Ye gods. In the world of advertising, it's even possible to have exciting armpits. At the same time that advertising glamorizes products, it trivializes human relationships, as we saw with the names optional, but particularly marriage. There are all kinds of ads like this. This says, bath tissue is like marriage. First of all, who calls it bath tissue? I mean, this is so bizarre. But I looked at this ad and I thought, what the hell are they talking about? I mean, what do they mean? You have to put up with a lot of crap? I don't know. What does it mean? But no, what it means is the longer it lasts, the better it is. So they do that. Or this more recent one, we now pronounce you husband and wife, you may kiss the gift. So it trivializes our relationship with our children. This says, we know what matters to you. And here the gear is in the child's safety seat, not the child. And it says, your gear is a priority. Now, I'm sure this is meant to be a joke, but still, what an incredible message this is, as is this one, a child is the ultimate pet. So in general, people are becoming ever less important, in general in our culture and in the ads, and things are ever more important, and we're encouraged to have a relationship with products rather than with people. Now, I first noticed this years ago when I saw this cover story in People on the children of divorce, wounded hearts, and sort of the harm that divorce does to children, allegedly, in this article. And then I noticed the ad that was on the back cover. The best relationships are lasting ones. What an amazing juxtaposition, because, of course, they're really talking about the relationship with the car. And that was when I began to see that we were being encouraged to, well, human beings, you know, you can't trust them, but products, that's a whole other story. The same applies to relationships. If it's not the real thing, move on, honey. So, you know, marriage, your brand of soft drink, what the hell, it's all the same. Some people need only one man or one woman or one watch. Get something just as hot for the garage. And this is all getting increasingly worse. This is one that ran fairly recently in lots of the glossy women's magazines, Vogue, Harper's Bazaar, that sort of thing. First of all, this incredibly, unbelievably thin person, woman, and the man is kneeling before her. Her pubic hair has been shaved in the Gucci logo. He's worshiping Gucci. She's not even, you don't see her face, she's not even present, really. It's Gucci. She's become the logo, the brand. And, you know, if that's not sufficient, how about this? The ultimate attraction. So we constantly get the message that we can't count on human beings, but we can commit to a brand, to a product, because after all, you can love it without getting your heart broken. And you certainly can't say that about a human being. So to love a human being is to be vulnerable by definition, but to love a car, that's another story. So it's not you, it's me. I need more space. I need a break. Can we just be friends? And at the bottom it says, lots of significant others, one car. So the car, again, is what you can count on. Men especially are getting the message that it's far safer to avoid commitment and responsibility in ads like this. Can't commit to a relationship, start with a sweatshirt. And if a man does get involved with a woman, sometimes people say to me, well, men are made to look like idiots in commercials too. And that's true, but you know, it's married men who are made to look like idiots in commercials. It's married men who, you know, can't find the cold medicine at night and can't wash the dishes and this sort of thing. So the real message is that men are contaminated by intimacy with women, that being in a committed relationship with a woman emasculates men. And in fact, it's like being hanged, basically, and you have to be really careful to hang on to your spirit. So here this guy is, you know, he's really about, it's as if he were losing his life, and here's this woman who's blissfully ignorant that she's marrying a moron. And women are told that since men are like this, we can only count on our products. This says, the ski instructor faded away 3 winters ago, at least the sweater didn't. So the sweater can be counted on, and we can fall in love with them. You've never been caressed like this before. How sad. So we're encouraged to feel passion for products, not for people. This is troublesome no matter what, but it's particularly troublesome when the products are addictive or potentially addictive, because addicts do feel in a relationship with the product or the substance that they're addicted to. So I want, and this is a major theme in the advertising of addictive products, so I want to just look quickly at that. Because the advertisers of addictive products understand addiction extremely well. So they know that people feel in a relationship with their product, and they use that ad after ad. Bring our family home for the holidays so the bottle becomes the family. It literally morphs into the woman. The bottle becomes the woman. In fact, it is man's other true love. And none of this is coincidental. It's all based on research on addiction and how people feel when they're addicted. Same thing is done with cigarette ads, friends and family. So the cigarette is the friend. And I remember when I smoked a long time ago, I felt my cigarettes were my friends. They didn't, you know, they wouldn't let me down. They were there for me. And after all, until I find a real man, I'll settle for a real smoke. Now, the food ads are offering food as a substitute for relationships, and there's more of this probably than anywhere else. And now, if you haven't noticed this already, you will from now on, so go out and look around you, but I'm going to show you a series of them where food is offered as a substitute for relationships. Spend your birthday with the ones you love. So the chocolate, the ones you love. You never forget your first love. Does quality time always have to be spent with a person? I mean, this sums it all up. Rekindle an old flame that's all passion and no baggage. Because after all, you know, these human beings, so much baggage. Love them all you want. Watch TV with your arm around the one you love. Because after all, no man will make you this happy. And sometimes food is sold much more erotically, as really as a kind of substitute for sex. See, I'm not making any of this up. Reunite your tongue with its first love. What you do in the dark is nobody else's business. What are they suggesting here? What are we supposed to do with this candy bar? You know? Trapped inside this wholesome rolled oats crust is a sultry little French pastry struggling to get out. Or here, a very recent one. Your lips look so lonely, may I keep them company? Your lips look so lonely, may I keep them company? At the bottom it says, the most seductive cookie ever. How bad do you want it? Yeah. Because after all, if you were any more satisfied, you'd blush. I rest my case. Now, these ads aren't aimed at children, of course, but children grow up in a world that's filled with these ads and these messages, and they absorb them. So this is what's happening as sexuality becomes colonized. So what can we do? Well, one of the most critical things, of course, is to address this from a progressive point of view, a point of view that doesn't deny the sexuality of teens and children, but refuses to allow it to be colonized by marketers or demonized by the right. It is the corporate exploitation of our children's sexuality that's disgusting and dangerous, not their sexuality. And we need more honest and open information about sex, not less. So one of the things we need to do, and media literacy, of course, plays a huge role here, is to educate and encourage parents. Because it's incredibly important for parents to talk openly with their kids. But many adults struggle to talk openly and comfortably about sex and sexuality with each other, let alone with their children. And I think so many parents these days just feel helpless. They don't know what to do. They feel so overwhelmed. So they even go into denial, or they just give up. I mean, they don't know what to do. In the past, of course, the prevailing cultural messages were much more compatible with the values that parents were trying to teach. Not always wonderful, but at least compatible. But these days, we have to, you know, fight against an onslaught. As, you know, my hero, George Gerbner, said, the stories were told by people with something to tell rather than by people with something to sell. And that's totally changed now. So that there's a grave disconnection between the messages. I mean, I certainly felt that raising a child in this culture, that the culture was hostile to everything I wanted for her. I had to fight it every single step of the way about everything, and it was exhausting, and it was impossible. You know, you can't do it by yourself. It's just impossible. And no wonder so many people feel helpless to do anything about this, because it's so overwhelming. The way we solve the problem is by recognizing that this is a public health problem. It's something that affects all of us, and the way we deal with public health problems is to change the environment, to change the norm. We need a lot of discussion, a lot of education, and a lot of course, media literacy. teaching our kids to be critical viewers. We need citizen activism. The Pussycat Dolls were going to be toys, you know, put out by Hasbro, until there was a lot of citizen activism, protest, dads and daughters and other groups, and they decided not to do this. So these are not going to be in stores aimed at our four-year-olds. We need, of course, sex ed, really good sex education, and because our children pay a huge price for our refusal to educate them. You know, I'm sure, in the states where they do teach, well, you can't teach anything but abstinence in the United States, so a lot of schools just opt out altogether and don't teach anything. But in the states where they do teach abstinence, the rates for STDs and teen pregnancy are much higher, not surprisingly. And today, one in every 10 girls in America under the age of 20 becomes pregnant in the U.S. each year, which is way more than any other developed nation in the world. It's like 9 times as high as in the Netherlands or Japan. And about 1 in 6 sexually active teenagers has already an STD. And even if they escape these consequences, they still pay a huge emotional price, because the sex ed they get teaches them basically that sex can kill you. So it's an incredibly negative, sort of horrifying message about sex. And there's nothing about pleasure or joy or connection. So it's hard to, how are they going to learn to say yes in a loving and responsible way when all they ever hear is just say no? So we need to, and they do this in other countries. They teach about relationships, about communication, about... They even teach in the Scandinavian countries how to, in middle school, something called couple communication, how to fight, how to deal with conflict in a relationship. That would help me a lot. It's just, imagine learning. There are skills. There are things you can learn, you know. But anyway, I've been involved for years with the Stone Center at Wellesley College, and my mentor and hero there is Jean Becker Miller, who died a couple of months ago. But she came up with a sort of statement about what is a healthy relationship. And she said that growth-fostering connections promote zest and vitality. You know, if you're in a good relationship, a healthy relationship, for the most part, it makes you feel more alive. It empowers you to act. It leads to a greater knowledge of oneself and others, and to an increased sense of self-worth, and it also leads to a desire for more connection. And conversely, you know, the unhealthy relationships do just the opposite. They make you feel dead and numb and passive and powerless, and decrease your sense of self-worth and all of that. So, but these are things that, you know, we can learn a lot about how to have these growth-fostering connections. It's not impossible to learn more about it and to encourage it. And if we could do that and challenge these images that we're getting and that our kids are getting, this could bring about true connection and healthier relationships for all of us, we grown-ups as well as our children, rather than the illusion and the distortion of connection and sexuality that we are surrounded with right now. So thank you, and now we will go on to have time for questions and discussion. Thank you. Thanks. Again, my website. So there's plenty of time now, and I'd love to get your questions, your discussion, your comments, things you've observed, anything like that. And if something strikes you later, my email address is on the website, so I'd be happy to hear from you. Yes? Mm-hmm. 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 Well, yes, I do. But boy, if you start looking at the sexual messages that we get, they're also ironic and crazy making. They're hypersexualizing children, but of course they don't want children to be sexually active. I mean, there's a lot of penalties for children who are, or kids who are. So it's all anti-sex, really. And it's all certainly anti-erotic. But I don't know. Do you have thoughts about that beyond... Oh my God, you are?
So they kind of Mm-hmm.
But they must be watching TV and everything, aren't they, or not? Really, huh? Huh. That's my daughter. When she was in high school, spent a month in Guatemala, you know, building things and stuff like that. And she came back, and she said that one of the best things about the experience was spending a whole month not caring how she looked, and that she was dreading returning to a culture that was going to make her care. And I thought, well, at least she's had that experience. You know, she sees that it's possible to step outside of this, you know, and to have that experience. But it's very difficult. Is there any other? Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, it's really always important for kids, of course, to have adults in their lives who love them and think they're special and who talk to them openly and who praise them for things other than, you know, how they look, but who also acknowledge their bodies and their sexuality and all of that. I mean, that's so obvious, and yet so few kids get it, you know. And I think that goes a long way towards helping, you know, to make them feel better about themselves, more resistant to these kinds of messages. But boy, I'll tell you, as a, you know, I hate to say this, but, you know, you're in this field too. I mean, you know, there couldn't be a kid more educated about this stuff than my child, you know, and she's not immune. I'm not immune, you know. I mean, there's just no way for individual parents to do this. We just cannot save our children child by child, house by house, you know. It's just too overwhelming, too difficult, and so that's why it's so important to say, hey, this is a really serious public health issue, and we've got to really address it, you know, as that change the environment. Yeah, way in the back. Well, you know, first of all, I'd say that's a great question for you to ask, you know, and it's really nice that you care about this girl and that you want to say something that's going to be helpful, you know, just acknowledge that. And I give every year I go and give a talk. I do Killing Us Softly basically at an all-boys prep school outside of Boston. I was pretty nervous the first time I did that, but it's gone well. And the question I get over and over again is, my girlfriend hates her body, my girlfriend thinks she's fat, what can I do, how can I help her? You know, it touches me, actually, because a lot of them really do want to know. And, you know, it seems one thing is, you know, if the condition is extreme, like body dysmorphic disorder or eating disorders or something like that, to get help, you know, to talk to an adult and try and get somebody to help. But if it's just your general run-of-the-mill self-hatred, then, so depressing. You're going to go out of here so depressed. I'm so sorry. But anyway, then I think you say that he could ask her, you know, or I'd say to them, why don't you try to find out more about it? Why do they say that? Why do they feel that way? Look at the images around them. Is some of it coming from that? And then look at real women's bodies and see what kind of variety there is and all of that. And, of course, always say, I think you're beautiful, you know, and I think you're not only physically beautiful, but you're beautiful because you have such a great sense of humor, et cetera, et cetera. You know, all of that, I think, can really be helpful. So, and that's a start, you know. But I think that acknowledging that this is really bizarre is a good thing, because we're so used to people, especially we're so used to girls and women doing this negative self-talk all the time, publicly, you know. And to just say, wait a second, that's really, you know, no way to talk to yourself, brings it into consciousness in a way that can be helpful, I think.